So here we go. Welcome to the latest RSGB Talk podcast. I'm Nick Rawlings, and my guest today is someone I know very well and have known for a lot of years, James Evans, founder of First Car. Hello, James. How are you?
Hey, Nick. I'm well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I've been looking forward to it because we do get on well, and we've known each other a long time, and I think it's going to be really enjoyable. So I hope the listeners enjoy it as much as I'm going to enjoy talking to you. So. I can remember way back, I mean, must be a long time ago now, Katie Brimley once from Essex had met you before I'd met you, and she said to me, I've met this chap called James Evans, and he's very much like a young version of you, Nick. And I was very flattered when I met you and saw you, but I've got to say, looking at us now, you're a much younger version of me. But it was a nice thing of Katie to say, and the more I've got to know you, the more pleased I've been with her assessment of us having similarities, because I think you're a very nice chap, and I've always enjoyed your company. So
likewise, Nick. Bless you. That's a really kind thing to say. Yeah, it's interesting. You sort of trade off this young entrepreneur thing for a certain amount of time, and then you kind of have to give it a rest, I think, in the mid-30s. So we're there now.
You're moving out of that phase.
Yeah, can't
you?
Trade off that anymore, unfortunately.
No, that's good. Anyway, let's go right back to the start, if we can. I think I know the story, but I'd love to... not all of our listeners will. So how did you get involved with road safety in the first instance?
Yeah, so you're right. You are talking back in 2001... Probably.
Really?
I mean, yeah, it sort of wasn't a passion for road safety, I'll have to say, at the very, very beginning. No. You know, I wanted to be an entrepreneur from a very young age. You know, me and Granddad, early teens, were melting down bits of lead that we found in the garage and, you know, taking it down the beach as fishing weights to sell. And then when mobile phones first came in before they'd hit the supermarkets, I was buying them off Exchange and Mart, and, you know, taking them to school and selling them to teachers. So yeah, it's started out very much as an entrepreneurial endeavor. I'd got this idea, sort of hit 17, 18, everyone's spending a lot of money learning to drive, spending a lot of money on their first car, insurance. I thought, wouldn't it be great to have a one-stop shop online, firstcar.co.uk perhaps, that could service all of those needs? And I thought, well, you know, there's certainly money in that, and there's certainly a large volume of people coming through every year. So I registered the domain name. It took me till 2004 to do anything about it, which is when we set up the sort of B2C business, if you like, First Car. And one of my ideas for getting into schools under the radar was a magazine originally called First Gear, until I was sent a cease and desist order by someone who owned the trademark. Okay. And then that changed to First Car. And then I got a call from, I don't know if it was Katie or June Howlett, it was someone, you know, still in road safety, but it's been involved for a long time. And they said this magazine could be a real asset as a road safety engagement tool.
Okay. So they came to you. Well, you didn't initially conceive it to be a road safety magazine, no?
Never. I didn't really know road safety was a thing. Yeah. You know, in that sense, I didn't realize how many, this is in the days of Larsoa, of course,
yes.
You know, how many
yes.
people were involved. So when I said, yeah, of course, I'll sell you 1,000 copies. I said, how many of you are there around the country? And I was very pleased with the answer that I got. And, you know, through the Larsoa website, I was managed to ring everyone up and find out, you know, what they wanted. And the First Car as a road safety concept was born, I suppose.
So how old were you then?
2004, I'd have been 21 by that point.
But you first conceived the idea of First Car as a concept when you were sort of 17, 18?
Yeah, that's when I registered the domain name and started. These things do take a little while, don't they, to germinate.
Absolutely. So what were the key points in the development of the idea? So you've mentioned one there, I guess, Katie or June or someone ringing you up and saying, you know, come and talk to me about this product in terms of road safety. But what were the other milestones in terms of how the project developed?
Yeah, so that's a really good point, actually. I think back, you know, particularly now that I don't have quite so much to do with the production of the magazine, to the days when we used to run our own photo shoots. You look back at the early editions and there's just friends from school and people you'd met in the town and roped into being on camera and then sitting on the designer's shoulder, kind of trying different concepts, different color schemes, working out what worked. And it did look like a desktop published magazine in the first place. I mean, there's no debating that. And within a couple of years, I think we'd taken it to something that was, you know, reasonably engaging and, you know, people certainly enjoyed reading as well as found informative. So, yeah, I think working out what the road safety topics that were important were, and I suppose the early days of behaviour change, how do you write something in a way that makes people think that, you know, certainly nothing as sophisticated as a behaviour change technique, but, you know, the belief was always there that we needed to change attitude and behaviour.
Yeah. So how did you fund it initially?
So I, when I was 18, I got a job with the Coast Guard because I live on the coast in Kent, and my boss there had made a bit of a killing through buy-to-let property in the late 90s, and we used to talk in the car about this idea. And one day he said, well, why don't I get some people in a room and you give them a pitch? So yeah. We had that investor, a guy that owned a VW dealership in Dover, Billy Hollis. He came in, and an ex-Dover Harbor Ball pilot put a bit of his own cash in there. And yeah,
Are they still involved?
Richard Storrs and I, we bought them out last year. Okay. So yeah, they've been involved for, 12 years at that point. Yeah.
Good. So let's go up to date then. So now tell us about where you are now with First Car, and not just First Car, but the portfolio of products and that you've got. How it's changed from what you started out with.
Yeah, I mean, wow, where do you start? I mean, obviously we've still got the Young Driver's Guide, which was the original First Car magazine. We've done Ultimate Guide to Cycling for cyclists.
Still publishing that?
Yeah, we are. In all honesty, it's lower volumes. I don't think we ever really made the kind of Sustrans impact. No. Perhaps because it didn't have a niche age group. People say you perhaps should aim it at cycle proficiency, bikeability levels and things. But we just did a broad brush, really. Mm. First Bike, which is much more popular. Drive On for older drivers. We do a Parents Guide as well. But of course, the real jewel in the crown now, I have to say, is the Theory and Practical Editions, which we published since 2011 with DVSA, that reach every new driver at the point of taking their theory test and their practical driving test, which some road safety teams across the country, they customize the cover and the centerfold pages to feature their local topics, which has been good. The events, which you know very well, Young Driver Focus, which started off at Arval, I remember,
five, six years ago.
And it's grown to sort of become a regular at the RAC club now. Young Rider Focus, we took a stab at with you guys last year. We're running, I don't know if anyone knows, but the Intelligent Instructor magazine that we have with Paul Caddick isn't under the First Car banner, but it was sort of started when Paul Caddick came to me, I think after ADI News had been sold, and said, how about starting something? And that's now turned into a conference, a website, which does incredibly well, and a monthly magazine for 15,000 driving instructors. Brilliant. So, it's incredibly exciting times. I'm very blessed to have a great team, with Richard and the other Richard, Russ and Carrie Ann, Anna, people like that, and partners like yourself.
So how many people are working with you now then?
Yeah, I mean, we don't really have tons of people on the payroll. We're a very lean business. And I've got to say, I was very grateful in sort of 2009-10 when, a lot of money was being pulled out of road safety that we hadn't got flash off it. We didn't have an office. We still don't. But we don't have a lot of people on payroll. We work a lot with freelancers, people around the country. So it allows us to kind of tap into the best talent, but on a part-time basis.
Best way to go, I think.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, good. Now, okay, so... Again, looking back slightly before we go forward again on to talk about young drivers particularly, what have been the high points and any low points you're prepared to share with us today in the journey you've taken in the last 16, 17 years?
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of low points, fortunately, there's not that many in road safety. It's such a wonderful group of people, and you know that only too well. I did feel, when 2009, 10, I think my chronology is just about right there, when all that hit and not so much the money being taken out of road safety, but the restructures and the uncertainty, a lot of people we'd built very strong relationships with, were unable to make decisions. They were very apprehensive about the state of their jobs and their colleagues' jobs. And yeah, I think everyone will remember that as being a very difficult time in road safety. But as I say, we were quite lean. So it allowed us to go through and come out the other side. In terms of high points, I mean, I think obviously the working with the DVSA on Theory and Practical Edition has been phenomenal.
How did that come about?
Well, there used to be a magazine called Drive On that people got when they passed their driving test. And it was a big A4. I mean, I got one. It was very sort of thick, heavily, obviously funded by advertising. Yeah. And I remember looking at this when I started First Car and thinking, well, that would be... phenomenal to be able to promote this website that we were going to launch to everyone and they pass a test. And it actually was out for, I think, a 5-year contract with a company that came up in 2008, 2009. And we pitched for it. I remember going up to Nottingham to do the pitch, and we came second. So we didn't win the bid. It was the incumbent. I mean, the incumbent always tends to win because they have the the list of advertisers for a magazine so dependent on advertising revenue, it was almost inconceivable they'd move. But I think they went bust in 2010, 2011, and nothing happened. There was no magazine. I think people were of the opinion that print could not be made financially viable on that scale. We're talking about 2 million magazines a year, remember. But fortunately, Richard Storrs is an excellent commercial mind.
Certainly is.
Yeah, he. I gave him a big wadge of cash, and he went to the company that had just gone bust and gave it to them for their advertising list, and that gave us a good starting point.
Brilliant.
At some point in the future, and I think I had to bang on various people's doors at DVSA for quite a long time until Bill Pope and Sarah Scott, who we've got a great relationship with, obviously backed by Leslie Young at the time. Said, God, we better get rid of this Evans guy. Let's just say yes, and we'll give it a go. And that's
fantastic.
That's where it all started.
Yeah, brilliant. Well done, you. That's fantastic. Right, now I'd like to change the focus slightly, if I may, now to talk about young drivers rather than first car, if that's okay. And I'm interested to know what the changes you've seen in terms of the issues that surround young drivers and their safety, and the casualties and the collisions that ensue from what happens. Has the picture changed in the time you've been involved? Have the issues changed?
It's a really, really good question. And I listened to the podcast you did with Johnny from the Think Campaign. I thought it was absolutely excellent. You know, he's got a very good sort of high-level academic understanding of the factors. And I think I'm coming probably from a less educated perspective. But my perception is that, yeah, I mean, the issues are broadly the same. Vehicle technology has changed enormously. You know, the cars themselves are safer.
Yeah.
But then you've got more prevalence of drug use, things like distractions in the car, social media. Yeah. This, I thought the always on term that he sort of coined in the podcast was quite good, a good way to describe advertising, but a good way to describe young people these days as well. And yeah, that comes with enormous challenges.
Can I just talk about the drug issue for a second or two? Because we did a piece yesterday on the news feed about the police campaign, drink and drug drive campaigns for this summer, which were launched, traditionally run in June every year. And two police forces, Essex and I think it was Merseyside, have come out and said they're now arresting more people for drug driving than they are for drink driving. Which is scary, really. I find that, I mean, it's probably not that surprising, actually, in a way, because, of course, previously they couldn't really test for drug driving easily. So now, of course, they can. But, I mean, that's really concerning, isn't it, that the prevalence of drug use amongst young people and the implications it has for road safety. Do you see that as a big issue or not?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I don't come from a background or a circle of friends where, you know, drugs is a something we talk about, or it's a real issue. I wouldn't claim to sort of know the scale of the problem on a personal level, but just seeing how society is now and the prevalence of drug use, it stands to reason that it's going to become an issue in the driving context. And, you know, there's no one sort of driver for drugs. Alcohol can kind of be put in a slight silo. You know, you're going out to drown your sorrows, or you're going out to have a good time. It's to lower your inhibitions. I mean, you can sort of tackle that. And I think the Think Campaign has done well as a local authorities with their sort of local interventions. Drugs is so embedded into the different social setups, depending on the type of drug you're taking. Drugs is such a broad term for a whole variety of stimulants, depressants. Again, I don't claim to know the technicalities of it, but it makes enforcing and educating around it a lot more complicated, particularly for people in road safety that probably, you know, we all go out and have a drink. We know what it's like to go down the pub and think about whether it's safe to drive back. Yes. Not everyone knows what it's like to do a line of coke and then make a decision about driving or not.
No, exactly right. Yeah, no, that's probably what scares me about it. I don't understand it, you know, so because it's not something that's been part of my culture. Whereas having a drink, you know, I do like a drink. You know, I have a drink socially and all that, but drugs has never been. But anyway, I just thought, for me, that seems to be the thing where that has changed probably in the last decade or so. It's the rise of drug use and the implications it has for road safety that I think amongst young people that is the issue. That's a major focus going forward for me. Now what about interventions and solutions? Where do you see the industry going in terms of how it's going to try and positively influence young people when they pass their test? I mean, has that changed in the 15 years? The way that we try, the techniques we try and use, the methods we try and communicate with young people, is that changing?
Yeah, I think it has. I think evaluation has become a much more important tool in working out what works and what doesn't work. I think, you know, the idea of setting aside 10% of your budget for something to, you know, either running a pilot in combination with evaluation or sort of at least making sure that the 90% is spent correctly, particularly with public money. And I think that sort of came in post 2009. There was less money, you know, as an entrepreneur, you know how to be resourceful. And so actually having less resources isn't as much of a challenge, or I don't see it as much of a challenge. And it helped in some ways, I think, road safety teams get sharper about what they do. There was less waste, which, you know, is something when there's a lot of money, yeah. It's very easy to do. So yeah, I think the simplification of how to embed behavior change techniques, things like the RAC report, and other fantastic work that's gone on, the academy. I mean, I did the RSGB practitioners course, and I still now in meetings quote things that I learned there, you know, the rule of 10 and theory of plan behavior, chance theory, risk or model of change, all of this stuff that I wouldn't have understood before has been made possible for road safety teams to embed quite neatly in work that they do. So yeah, I think everything's a bit more joined up now. I do, again, Johnny mentioned it's harder now with mass media to kind of take a slot on ITV. You know, before Noel's House Party in, you know, the late 90s, everyone knew that if you saw it then, it was as important as what was going to happen on, you know, your favourite show, and it kind of elevated it. But media's more fragmented now. I think it's harder for road safety teams to do stuff on a local level. Easier for road safety teams to do stuff on a local level, but harder perhaps on a national broad brush approach.
Yeah. What about VR? There's a lot of talk about VR within road safety and a lot of interest in it. What's your involvement with it, and what's your view in terms of VR as a tool?
Yeah, so VR, I mean, the fact that everyone's talking about it is great. That's really encouraging. I mean, for me, VR as a road safety tool was the concept was kind of born when Paul Spate and I were in the bar, I think 2014 National Conference. I feel like a lot of these stories start in bars, but National Conference 2014. And we said, we were having a bit of a pop at crash cars and the idea that, you know, you have to black all the windows out and that the screens are very small and the vibrations from the machines are no way indicative of a real crash. And I said, wouldn't it be great if you didn't have to have the windows blacked out? People wore headsets and everyone could look in and see what the reactions are, and you became less reliant on the hydraulics and all this sort of stuff. And Paul said, what about VR? And we said, well, you know, how would that work? And could you sync everything together? And the technology was at a very early stage. And Paul said, look, I've got a bit of money. We won't fall out if it doesn't work, but let's give this a go and see what we can do. And we found a few freelancers and we did a lot of research on VR, and we pulled this kind of crash car concept together for no other reason, really, just to see whether it was something that had legs. And we published that. And I mean, that's just gone. I mean, that was in April 2015, we shot that, and it's just gone global. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, looking back now, what we managed to achieve in 3 hours in an afternoon, if I was planning a VR shoot now, that would have been a 2-day shoot. Yeah. There was a lot of luck, I think, in pulling that together in the way that we did. And I think from a content point of view, certainly we wouldn't have gone for the blood and the gore and some of the things that we did. But one thing I will say is that with all the evaluation and, you know, worry about academia, sometimes it can really stifle creativity. Mm. And the one thing that I really enjoy looking back on is how inventive we were being at the time. We weren't worried about running a pilot. We said, look, let's just give it a go. Let's give it our best shot. We'll research. We'll, a bit like Steve Jobs says, you know, he was never a big fan of focus groups because he said if you'd have sat people down in 1999 and said, you know, what do you want the next CD player to look like? They'd have wanted a smaller disc, or they'd have wanted something. They would never have conceived of the iPod. And I'm not saying that that sort of road safety's move into VR is a quantum leap like that, but it just shows sometimes you have to just be creative and just try things out.
And follow your instinct.
And follow your instinct. It's a really good point. Yeah, if you've spent a little bit of time in road safety, I think you can... I think it's safe to trust your instincts a little bit.
You have to, I think, sometimes. You know, I mean, there is obviously a role for evaluation, but sometimes you just get a feel for something. You think this is worth pursuing, and then you've got to, of course, you've got to test it down along the line. But without instinct, without nous, it's, you know, entrepreneurs wouldn't exist, would they? You know, because that's what tends to lead them to where they end up.
You're right. Small calculated risks with public money, nothing too big.
No, absolutely. Good. So you think VR's got a major part to play going forward in terms of road safety interventions targeting young people particularly?
Well, it's not a panacea. I will say that it shouldn't be thought of as such. I do think people were too quick to try and evaluate the VR film that Paul and I did when it first came out. I think what it actually needed was sort of the timescale we've had now, maybe 2-3 years of different types of VR. So you have that kind of first-person VR, you have third-person VR, you have interactive, non-interactive. We have stuff that's more instructional, stuff that's more emotional. And I think you needed that kind of broad set of VR films to then, now's the right time to go and run an evaluation on the different styles and work out A, if VR works at all, and B, you know, which techniques within VR are most effective at reaching different types of people. But I would say if you look at, you know, it's being used to train doctors, pilots, it's being used in dementia care. I think there's a lot of research out of the road safety sphere that shows VR is effective at doing certain things. We do know, you know, you put a VR headset out and a young person's drawn to it, you know, so it will certainly help with engagement, even if the content of the VR is not necessarily 100%, the conversation that you can have with them before and after, and that kind of engagement by the fact you're trying VR is certainly valuable as well.
Good. Right, now I'm going to close this by asking a little bit about the future for you and your organisation. And you described yourself at the outset of this interview as an entrepreneur, and I do see you as an entrepreneur, but not a typical entrepreneur, because I've never seen sort of money as being the driving focus for you. But so if you're an entrepreneur, what's the future hold? Do you see yourself wedded, tied into road safety forever? I mean, you're still a very young man in many ways. Or do you see yourself... Have you got a burning desire to go in other directions, or are you happy where you are? And then secondly, the second question is first car. What's next on the agenda for first car? So two questions, really. You might want to take the second one first, or the first.
Yeah.
Talk about first car first, and then we'll talk about you afterwards.
Yeah, no, I will. For first car, I mean, we're so lucky now. We've got a great team. Richard Storrs, you know, on commercial, you know, we work with fantastic partners like yourself and everyone else at Stenic on events, and Richard Borgs on digital. It's finally a time when I think, you know, I could step away from First Car and it would continue to run as effectively, if not perhaps even more effectively in some senses than it does currently. The business is growing, we're doing new things which aren't things necessarily that I've dreamt up for the first time ever. Other people are coming up with great ideas and they're actually going out there and making them happen. So I'm really pleased that is how it is now, and I'm sure in the next couple of years I will do something else. Whether that is keeping a hand in first car or moving away entirely.
Give us any clues or not?
I don't know, really. I mean, I've always liked this idea of a business that helps people work from home or helps people enjoy life a little bit more. I think we've been very lucky. I've been very lucky, I feel, to have had a good lifestyle while running First Car. And I think a lot of people can do that with modern technology, even in, you know, more mainstream jobs where they're not the boss. You know, they can work remotely and stuff. So, yeah, maybe stuff like that. My wife, Victoria, she launched, she quit her job as a lawyer in the city, and she started... it's Teen Health magazine about 2 years ago, which is doing well now. She told me that I can't get involved in that. That's hers. Yeah. But there's certainly stuff to do.
Good. Great. I've enjoyed it. Thank you, James, very much for spending the time with us today. And it's been, as I thought it would be, interesting to talk to you. And I enjoy what you're saying about what your future plans are. And I congratulate you on the success you've had so far. And I hope that maybe at some point in the future we might do another podcast in 12 months down the line or something and have another catch-up. So thanks very much for coming in and spending the time with us.
All right. Thank you so much for having me. Thanks, Nick.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye.